It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and this hour we have three experts available to answer your questions. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will join us in a few minutes. But we're going to start the hour with a great opportunity for gardeners to get acquainted with new plants and new ideas. Iowa State University Field Days. Cindy Haynes is an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and she's here to tell us about Field Days. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And the Field Days start next week, right?
They start on Monday of next week in Armstrong near Atlantic.
All right. And tell me a little bit about the Field Days and the farms or the demonstration acres that these places are going to be held at.
Right. So we have five different Field Days across the state. They start on Monday near Atlantic at the Armstrong Research Farm. And they continue through August 9th, where we end up at the Nashua, or near Nashua at the Northeastern farm up there. They're usually, these field days are usually in the evenings. It's the same garden planted at all five locations, and they have kind of the same themes. And I tour around and we talk a little bit about what's done well, what hasn't done well, and people, attendees, get to see some of the different plants that are in the garden, maybe even try a few things if they're, you know, producing, so they can taste this tomato and compare it to what they have in their own garden.
Now, of course, the climate differs a little bit in
right.
Iowa from place to place. So why plant the same things at all of the demonstration farms?
Well, the climate is a little bit different. One place will be, you know, more wet or moist than another. In fact, one of our farms was flooded out this year at the Rock Rapids farm. So that, you know, that tells us something. It also, each of these farms have different types of soil. One of the farms is the Muscatine Island Research Farm, which is a very sandy soil, and they have to irrigate quite a bit to make sure everything stays alive. So we talk about those different conditions, and then we also, and I present that, you know, regardless of these different conditions, there are some plants that have done amazingly well at all locations. So if they've done well at all locations, then we can say it will probably do well in your garden.
Tell me about some of the things that people will be seeing this year. We've talked about the color purple here on this show in the past, and I know that it's making a big splash at your demonstration farms this year.
Yes, purple vegetables are the focus or one of the themes. And the fun part of that are some of the purple tomatoes. There's one tomato called Indigo Rose that we have on the College of Agriculture website, and it's a really purple-black, kind of a larger cherry-type tomato. So it's very different and fairly new. We also have Cherokee Purple, which is an heirloom, kind of larger, unusual-shaped purple tomato. We also have purple potatoes that we'll dig up, hopefully, this year at the farms as well. So you'll get to see, they're called blue potatoes, but they're all purple. And I have five or six different cultivars that are purple skin on the outside and then this dark purple, almost black on the inside. They make the most amazing French fries. So it's just kind of interesting to see potatoes in different colors. And then a whole assortment of other kind of purple vegetables, bell peppers, eggplant, you name it. If it's purple out there, there's purple cauliflower. We've got it in the garden.
Was this your idea?
Yes, of course it was.
So a lot of us are starting to see ripe produce in our gardens, but also a lot of us got a late start because it was chilly this spring.
Sure.
Are things getting ripe? Are they going to be ripe in time for the field days?
Well, we never know. Every year's a little bit different. We plan for a mix of different things so that there's at least something that we can taste or try or look at. And that's also why we have a lot of flowers in the garden as well. So even if, you know, tomatoes aren't ripe and ready, we have some other things that we're looking at the same time. Most of the gardens were planted in May, so that's pretty good. Last year, some of the gardens didn't get actually planted until early June. So we're a little bit ahead of the game there. Many of the gardens haven't had to water as much because we've had some nice regular rainfall. And so I think things will be kind of on, well, we'll be a little bit on time. So I think we'll have some things to taste or try. And potatoes should be ready. We can dig up a few of those, even if they're new potatoes, to take a look at.
Now, one of the things that you will be demonstrating at the gardens this year are different kinds of impatience plants. And I know people love impatience so much, and a lot of people have realized that they can't plant the impatience they've been planting forever because of downy mildew.
Right.
But you have some varieties that are resistant?
Right. We are planting this year. This is the first year we've ever had impatiens in the garden, because impatiens are typically a shade-loving flower, and there's no shade at any of these demonstration gardens. So this year we actually found there's a new series of hybrid New Guinea impatiens. New Guinea impatiens are resistant to downy mildew, so that's one plus. New Guineas usually tolerate more sun than the regular impatiens too, so that's a second plus. And now they have this new series called Sunpatiens that will tolerate full sun. So we're putting them to the test at all these different locations, whether they're highly irrigated or not, and to see how they perform in this kind of full sun, hot weather, right next to some typical New Guinea impatiens and the old heirloom impatient called Rose Balsam or Touch Me Not. It's just tough as nails. Yeah.
And the New Guinea impatiens, if it tolerates more sun, is it also still as tolerant of shade?
They do. They do pretty well in shade as well. The New Guinea impatiens, I will say, don't perform as well in deep shade as the typical impatiens, but they do prefer that kind of half shade, half sun kind of a location. But like I said, these are larger plants or smaller plants. There's like six different series or six different cultivars that we're featuring, three different series that should be able, and they're doing pretty well at the Hort Station in Gilbert.
All right. And have you travel around to all of these.
Right.
Have you been to all of the demonstration farms recently, or are you going to have some surprises as you arrive there on the day of the field day?
I always have surprises whenever I arrive. There's always something that doesn't do well. There's always something that I hope does really well, and turns out to be a total bomb in most of the gardens. So, and that's the nice thing about this is that there are some things that I know are going to do well and some things that I don't know. And we always kind of figure that out as we travel around. I hear from some of the farm superintendents, you know, I always plant some kind of unusual things in there too. And they call sometimes or email and ask me, what is this? What is that? and there's a few things that, you know, reseed, and they learn it well and they hate it the next year because it's seeded everywhere. So, yeah, but they still invite me back.
Well,
so that's
nice.
A good thing.
That's nice. So you also have some zinnias that will be on display. Tell me about those.
We have some compact zinnias this year. Everyone likes zinnias. There's some disease-resistant zinnias out there, and there's some disease-resistant compact zinnias. So we thought about zinnias that were small or shorter, that are bed and border kind of zinnias, and we have, I think, 20 different cultivars on display. So lots of colors of zinnias. Everyone can take a bouquet.
So where do you get your ideas for some of these more unusual items that you plant?
Richard and I usually sit down in the winter and we talk about a few things. Inspiration comes from our garden catalogs. So it's cruising through all those catalogs or looking through some of those websites or looking at some of the things that we've seen in gardens the year before. We think about things. So the Sunpatiens is one that Richard and I talked about doing and putting together. The purple vegetables is all me. Richard won't claim any credit on that one, I don't think. So it's kind of a mix. We also ask some of the attendees to the field days, what do you want to see? You know, what do you want for next year? So we did raised beds one year because several of the gardeners wanted to see how things grew in raised beds. We did grafted tomatoes because it was a new thing. So, and some people wanted to see how they perform. So it's a kind of a mix of ideas from a lot of different people. So you can offer some ideas for next year.
Is there something from recent years that you've tried out and has just been a tremendous success that maybe you've put in your own garden or recommended to a lot of people?
I think the raised beds worked really pretty well for some locations last year, so we're always recommending raised beds, and we showcased kind of different styles of raised beds, so they weren't raised much. The grafted tomatoes I wasn't that impressed with last year, so I decided not to put that in my garden this year, or we didn't do something right with the grafted tomatoes to make it work. So I think every year I gain something. There's always a few cultivars that I always like to include because I liked it and it did so well in the gardens in the years past. So I'm always planting some of the same onions or potatoes or tomatoes that we've had in the past at the home demonstration garden.
It sounds like a dream come true to mm-hmm. be able to plan your garden and try out new things and have somebody else do the weeding.
It is it is awesome. Let me tell you, 5 or 6 gardens across the state, I send out all these plants and I show up for the field day and they always look beautiful. I always have something to discuss. We walk around the garden and I had to do very little work. It's the way to garden.
All right. So the first field day is on Monday the 21st at the Armstrong Research and Demonstration Farm near Lewis. And
right.
You have field days all throughout next week and I guess a couple weeks after, through August 9th. We put up a link on our Facebook page if you go to Iowa Public Radio, where you can see an article about them and a rundown of all the events that are coming up. And anybody can come to this?
It's open, free and open to the public, so anyone can come. Most of the field days start about 6:30. The exception is the Nashua Field Day on August 9th. That one starts at 4 o'clock. It's on a Saturday afternoon. These usually run for a couple of hours. We tour through the garden, and then many of the stations will also give us a tour of a couple of other things at the farm as well. So you might see, you know, sweet corn or melons at Muscatine. You might see, I think, raspberries maybe at the Hort Station, biochar at the Armstrong farm. So there's something else usually on display as well. And everyone is welcome.
All right. And again, you can find that information on our Facebook page. And of course, you can find it online with Iowa State University Extension as well. We're going to take a short break and then we'll be back to answer your questions about your yard, your garden, your trees and your landscape. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. With me right now, Cindy Haynes, an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Cindy Haynes. She's an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Richard Giron is here, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Mark Vitosh is here as well. Three experts for the price of one today, DNR Woo-hoo. District Forester. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And you're all ready for Ragbri, right?
Tomorrow morning.
All right.
Head west.
Very
ready to
exciting.
Go.
All right. Let's get to some questions. Jan is on the line in Atlantic. Hello, Jan.
Good morning. My question is about future plantings of replacement butterfly bushes. I had 6 very healthy butterfly bushes here in Atlantic for years. This winter, this spring, wiped them out. This is a somewhat colder area mm-hmm. than zone 5, USDA 5. I think it's 4. Should I not replant them in the future?
You can replant them. Butterfly bushes are kind of on that marginally hardy zone. They didn't survive in my garden last year either. It was a pretty cold and pretty brutal winter because of it. They are fairly late to emerge in the spring. Of course, they should have come out. You've grown them before. You know that they should have been up
mm-hmm,
by
mm-hmm,
now.
Mm-hmm.
Replanting them, if you maybe want to invest in maybe a fewer number, 1 or 2 would be a good idea. And then maybe mulch them heavily in the fall. They will die back down to the ground. And this is going to be just one of those things. I think it's the genetic capacity of the plant. It's not a zone 4, zone 3 hardy mm-hmm. Plant. So it may be fine, you know, through next winter, but, you know, 2 or 3 winters in the future, it may completely die out again. But that's
well,
a good opportunity to change the cultivar and try something new.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
All
Bye-bye.
Right, Jan, Bye-bye. Thanks a lot for your mm-hmm. call. And let's go to an email question here, as long as I can see it. It seemed like that was going to be easier than it was turned out to be. All right, this is from Nate. I have a few Arctic Fire dogwoods that seem to have issues every year. Some leaves turn brown or have spots, and some stems have very rough, dark bark. They also seem to get aphids about this time every year. They're about 6 or 7 feet tall now. Would it be beneficial to cut them all the way to the ground? And if I should, when should I do it?
I'm not familiar with that variety. I would assume the spotting could be due to a leaf spot, like Septoria, which is very common on many of the shrub-type dogwoods. The roughness on the bark might be due to a canker, which we see on some of the dogwoods also. If it's a multi-stem shrub, which I'm assuming it is, I guess what I would do is in March or early April, I would take out some of the bigger stems near the ground, kind of open it up so you have better air circulation, hopefully better conditions for the plant, where you have less disease as far as foliage and also on the cankers.
He might want to take some samples into his local extension office, too, just to diagnose exactly what's going on and see if this is going to be an ongoing issue.
All right. Nate, I hope that helps. And Kathy sent this in from Ames. My endless summer hydrangea bushes are growing well and are nice and green, but no flowers. Is there anything I can do to get them to flower?
Well, with those, they potentially can bloom on both new wood, typically in late summer, but also on the previous year's growth in early summer. Now, because of the cold temperatures this past winter, the previous year's growth was totally destroyed. So they're not going to bloom until possibly late summer on the new growth.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Bill is on the line in Indianola. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I've had these grasses for about almost 9 years. They grow up to be about 12 feet high, and they've got these little seedy things on top. And when I cut them back, I cut them about 2 feet from the ground. And this year, they didn't come up.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few little strands of the grasses. But my question is, will they come back?
I don't think they're going to fully recover. That was kind of surprising to me, too, that many of the ornamental grasses did not come back this spring. And I think the problem was the extremely cold soil temperatures. We had temperatures much colder than normal as far as soil temperatures, and plant roots are not really that hardy. And so I think it was actually the cold soil temperatures that destroyed many of these plants.
Yeah, I pulled them out. They were rotten on the bottom.
Yeah, right. Right, which was very surprising. Typically, they're very reliable, but some of the ornamental grasses like the miscanthus, some of those simply did not come back at all or very, very poorly. And they're coming back so poorly, they're just not going to recover.
Is there a good replacement?
I think there are still some very good ornamental grasses out there. For example, I would look at some of the cultivars of our native grasses. For example, there's some really nice switchgrass varieties out there, like North Wind, for one, a really nice one. Also, the feathered reedgrass seem to do very, very well, which is a very common one.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Bill. Thanks a lot for your call. And here's another email question from Derek in Cedar Rapids. In part of our flower garden, there are horn-shaped fungi or mushrooms growing. They are red with orange stem and a slimy brown cap. The part of the garden, I can just let you start now, but the part of the garden where they are at is fairly moist and shaded with black mulch. Hostas and ferns are growing there. What are they, and is there anything we can do about them?
Those are stinkhorns.
Yeah.
And they look like a horn. They're shaped like one. And they also stink.
They do. Stinkhorns.
Basically, the cap is very slimy, and that smell attracts the flies, which crawl on it. And then they pick up spores and disperse the actual spores. So they're kind of gross-looking. They are. But they're temporary. They typically shrivel up in a few days. So if you find those obnoxious, which some people do, you can just scoop them up and discard them.
All right. But if you can ignore them long enough, they will go away.
Yep.
All right. That's good news. That's my favorite kind of problem. You can join our conversation today at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jean is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Jean.
Good morning. I have a blue spruce tree that looks very healthy. It's probably, I don't know, almost as tall as our house, but the bottom is dying off. The tree seems to continue to grow and new candles every year, but the bottom is the bottom branches. Is this a sun issue or is this typical? Although I see beautiful ones with branches all the way to the ground, which is what I really like. But what suggestions?
Jean, this is a most likely we have some real common diseases on blue spruce. When they start off, they look great, but as they get older, we have a couple what we call needle casts that can actually have an impact on spruce, even if they're in open areas. If they're in a denser area, sometimes it even gets worse. But what tends to happen, it starts at the bottom of the tree and it works its way up. And it usually starts on the inside of the branches and works its way out towards the tip. So as you look at that plant, you'll see tips, but everything on the inside in that lower portion will be gone. If you take some of the inner needles of those branches that appear to be impacted, you can take them into your local extension office, and they can look a master gardener, or they can send them to Ames, and you can look on those needles, and on those needles you'll actually find little black dots that are growing in what we call the stomates, and that's actually fungi. And there's two specific fungi that can impact those. And what happens if we leave that there, one's called rhizosphere needle cast, the other one's called stigmina. We've talked about it many times over the years. But basically, if you do nothing, eventually that will start to work its way up the tree. And a lot of it is weather dependent. On years like this, you will tend to see more infection. In 2012, I got no calls on that disease because it was too dry. And if you leave it alone, eventually you'll start to get what we call some canker diseases because those trees become stressed, and it can slowly start to kill that tree. The challenge is the treatments are fungi or fungicides in a preventative mode, and you'll have to treat those trees sometimes twice a year or even multiple times every year for the rest of that tree's life to try to reduce or prevent that problem.
Okay. Well, that's...
But I would get it diagnosed. I would get it diagnosed first to make sure that's what it is. Because sometimes just shade alone, if you have some other vegetation coming up through there, or the grass is a little thick, can cause similar symptoms. But if you take it in, it's pretty easy to diagnose. So at least you'll know what's going on.
All right, Jean, thank you so much for your call. And next up, we've got Joanne on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Joanne.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I'm getting kind of frustrated. Something keeps building webs, like spider webs, on my green bushes, my yews and mugo pines and other landscape bushes, and then also on my potted plants. And I destroy the webs, and I've sprayed with a little bit of dish soap and water, but I keep seeing more webs. And I don't know what it is or what else I can do about it.
Well, if it were a spider, they don't really harm plants, so you don't have to worry about that part of it. You could just maybe take a garden hose or just a stick or something and tear them out. If they were spider mites, they can actually damage plants. They're not actually spiders, but they're very, very tiny. The weather hasn't really been favorable for them, so I don't think it's spider mites. So I'm guessing it's some type of spider, which probably isn't that much of a concern, actually.
All right. Joanne, thank you so much for your call. And next up, we've got Tom in Iowa City. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Charity. I have a real oddball question. I mentioned that to your screener, and she said, I love oddball questions.
We may not, but...
She speaks for herself. All right, Tom.
My question is, some trees, on occasion, will send their roots above ground, lying on the ground, and then scoot them back underground. And I was wondering why they do that.
Well, Tom, I'll tell you, is they're not actually – the reason those roots are above ground or close to the surface might be the soil itself. Often in our urban areas, especially in our communities where there's a lot of compaction, you got to remember that roots need oxygen, moisture, and nutrients. And if those soils are heavily compacted, those roots can only establish in those areas. And there are some species, though, like silver maple, green ash, willow, cottonwood, that generally grow in floodplains where that environment is shallow anyway. So that's their kind of natural habitat as far as how they survive. And I wouldn't say that they really disappear, but what happens is basically that if that root is close to the surface, it does raise up, but it also grows underground. So it may sink a little bit or appear to sink, but really they're adapting to those growing conditions, and some species will do it more than others. But even an oak species, if it's a tough, compacted site, may have shallow root systems in that area.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we'll go to Bonnie. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi, I've got a question about an established lilac bush and the way that the previous owner had handled it. It's a tall stem, and then the bush is at the top. It's probably 3 or 4 feet off the ground before the leaves start. So at the bottom of the stem, there are all kinds of little suckers starting up mm-hmm. all the time, mm-hmm. and they don't look very good, and I would like to get rid of them. Is there an easier way than going out and cutting all of them by hand with my clipper? And I wonder, can I use Roundup on them, or will that hurt the bush?
You can definitely do not use Roundup on them, because they're coming up from the roots. Those suckers are coming up from the roots of the plant, so you cannot use Roundup on them.
That was what I thought.
Yeah. If you don't like the suckers coming up, you're going to have to periodically remove them with the pruning shears.
Okay. So there's no easier way than just the hand way.
No. That's just the nature of the beast. That's what the lilacs do. They tend to sucker. Most of them do, at least. And so if that's their natural habitat or habit, then you're just going to have to do that periodically.
Okay. Well, thanks. I was looking for an easier way, and I knew if there was one, you guys would know it.
Sorry.
Yep, Bonnie, thanks a lot for your call. This is a question from another Tom. He says he wants to know when to transplant horseradish, late fall or early spring, or none of the above.
Well, what they possibly could do is they could harvest late in the fall, like in November, and use most of it. But take some of the smaller roots and transplant those.
Yeah, okay. Horseradish is pretty tough.
It's very tough.
So I don't think it matters if it's late fall, early spring, middle of summer. I think it'll still make it.
I'm just thinking the best quality produce would be in November. So.
That's good.
All right, so you might as well make the most of what you're doing. All right, this is David in Allamaquee County. Hi, David.
Hi. I've got a problem with a couple of milkweed plants. They came up last year, I think the year before, and this year, and flowered and everything. And this year, they came up and grew well until they got about 2 feet high. And then the rest of the growth now is the leaves are shrunken and turning yellow, rolling in on themselves, and produce only a couple of little florets. I saw a monarch out there trying to feed off of that, and so I'm wondering if this is a disease or what. I'm not near any cornfields where there'd be any insecticides.
Right. I've noticed that I've had fewer milkweeds in my garden than in the past, and I think it was because of the cold temperatures, particularly the cold soil temperatures. And they were a little later to get started than they have in the past. But I'm looking at Richard and Mark, and I haven't noticed any other diseases on milkweed.
Well, they're a plant. I'm sure they can have something, but
or a leaf roller, maybe.
But as far as herbicides, if nothing else in the area shows signs of damage, then I would discount that, because there should be a fairly distinct pattern if there was herbicide damage. So, probably not that.
Other plants would also show curling and cupping mm-hmm. and stuff if herbicides were involved. Mm-hmm. I always go back to this because I think it's a great resource. I would take some pictures or samples into his county extension office, and if there's a master gardener or someone that they can send it to in Ames, just to see what might be going on. And if it's a low area too, maybe there's some moisture issues or something like that too, but they could at least maybe eliminate disease or insect issues.
All right. And so probably next year they'll be back to normal, sounds like.
Wait,
hopefully,
see.
Hopefully.
Okay. I'll take the optimistic angle here from my my lack of expertise. David, thank you so much for your call. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron, and Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and with me, Cindy Haynes, an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron, and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Larry is on the line next in West Des Moines. Hi, Larry.
Well, hi, Charity, and thanks for taking my call. It's probably a simple question, but I have a crabapple tree that is giving me fits. I get about 2 gallons of apples every week, and I'm going to have that professionally removed. It's about a 12-year-old tree, and it's just to the north of my deck and back, so I need something there for privacy. Can I plant another tree in that same area if I have that tree professionally removed, or what would you suggest?
I would say yes, you can. I mean, you can have that stump removed. I wouldn't have it pulled out, but you could just have it ground down, and you could probably go a foot or two one side or the other of that. I wouldn't go right back in that exact spot, but if you can just move it a foot or two one direction or another, you could put another tree in that spot.
Well, that sounds good. What kind of a tree would you recommend at this time of year?
How tall a tree do you want?
I need one that's about 15 to 20 feet tall, perhaps.
Well, what is the exposure of the area? I mean, is it a south-facing, east-facing, north?
It's a north-facing location right at the tip of my deck there on the north side of my house.
Do you have room for it to spread a little bit?
I've got about 12 feet between me and my neighbor, so it's going to be pretty close to my lot line area there, but they won't mind it because they'll appreciate the privacy also.
The one species I'm thinking of, Cindy and Richard, is Japanese pagoda tree. Or, I'm sorry.
Lilac?
No.
Pagoda dogwood?
Pagoda dogwood, thank you. I had Japanese tree lilac on the mind there.
Okay.
But pagoda dogwood is one that I'm thinking of that
nice.
Might be a little wide for that area, but especially as far as the environment and stuff, it would fit pretty well.
And it's prunable, so it's one that you can kind of keep in bounds.
Another one, if you can let it get a little taller, would be a redbud. You know, we've had issues with redbud because of the winters and stuff, but if you get something from a northern source, that's another option. Do you guys have any others?
I would think possibly an ornamental pear, possibly, ornamental pear.
And I was also thinking service berry, but then you have the fruit issue again.
But the one thing with the service berry is it's going to come. Usually the birds beat you to it, and it's gone. So from the sense of that, it doesn't tend to be – it's a short messy.
Really messy, right.
And not really messy. So that I like that idea also.
I like the fall color on it too, so it's pretty
good. And you'll get some spring flowers with that like you would a crab. But those fruit are not going to stick around.
Nope.
All right, Larry, I hope that gives you some ideas. And we have this email from Michael in Iowa City on a similar topic. He says, is there a guide available that recommends shade trees for yards to replace my ash trees with different pros and cons, possible diseases or pests? This seems to be a more difficult project than I anticipated.
Well, if you go to iowadnr.gov and if you go to a couple of the Iowa State Extension sites, there are some good lists out there. And actually, some of those lists come from Dr. Jeff Isles and give alternatives to ash trees. And they list shade trees. He also has some smaller, low-growing trees. And a lot of times in there, it'll give the characteristics as far as their width, fall color, different sizes, and those kind of things. So, yes, there are some sources. But one way to get to that, if you go to iowadnr.gov and then go to forestry, and then if you go on forest health or plant health and get into emerald ash borer, you'll find a good list in there as alternatives.
All right. And he's also wondering if he can find a list of locations of these trees or trees that are planted so he can take a look. But we do have a number of arboretums in the state, right?
Yeah. There's you have Clinton. You have Clinton Arboretum, Bickelhop Arboretum, the Iowa Arboretum near Ames.
Dubuque.
You actually have Ryman Gardens is
Dubuque,
an
yeah.
excellent Dubuque. Mm-hmm. There's actually one in Newton that they have developed, mm-hmm. and there's also one in Waterloo at the community college.
And the Brinton Arboretum.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So there's multiple places all over. And also, too, you can go online a lot of times and Google those species, and they'll show you different pictures within the landscapes. But that's an excellent thing to do because a lot of times folks will buy species, they think they like it, it has a certain characteristic they like, and then it gets in the landscape, and they go, well, I didn't realize those leaves are that big, or
right.
they did this or did that. But that's excellent that he's thinking ahead that way because that's a great way to minimize concerns later by really doing a good job in the selection process.
All right. Good luck with that project, Michael. A lot of people are participating in the same project right now. So Philip is on the line now in Muscatine. Hi, Philip.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, my question will be from Mark. Several years ago, he came down to our property. It's a tree farm, kind of a hobby farm, and we walked the property, and he put together a really nice timber management program for us. And, you know, we've implemented a lot of the things that he mentioned, you know, trimming out certain trees, cutting the vines. And my question is, when we did this, we found numerous oak trees with damage to the leaves that was caused by pesticide damage. And, you know, over the last couple of years, I've seen some more damage to the oak trees. It almost looks like an infection, but it was caused by pesticide damage. My question is, what can we and other listeners do to help prevent this from happening?
Well, I tell you, Philip, if you really think that that is a potential, and there are some herbicides that potentially can cause what we call oak tatters, which we've been watching probably since 1994, 1995 across Iowa, and actually this year the evidence of it has been pretty significant throughout different parts, especially in the eastern part of the state. If you think there's a direct connection in your area, the best thing you can do is you can report your concerns to the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship. Give them a call so an investigator can come out and look at the situation. The challenge with that particular situation, though, is these chemicals don't always come from the field next to you. These chemicals are throughout the area, and it's often hard to target. But if we make folks like this aware of this, they can look at that. And there's actually been research from the University of Illinois. It's clear back from 2004 and 2005 that makes a direct correlation between specific herbicides and that condition. So there is information out there, and there's actually been a study down at Iowa State that actually duplicated the Illinois study, but it has not been published yet, and so we keep pushing them to get that done so that information can get out there. But it is a concern. So the more you can do to make local folks aware of those concerns, that's the best way we can get the word out there.
Okay. Great, Mark. Do you think once the word is out, are we going to be able to take steps to prevent this then from being used in the fields, or what do you expect will happen once other people are, aware of what products are harming this? Can we take those away, or do we just ask our neighbors not to use certain products that are causing the damage? What do you think would happen? Well, or should happen?
Well, I hope in some situations it could be as simple as timing. It's really challenging because of the weather and stuff in the spring. A lot of times they have to get out in the fields in a very short period of time, and there's abundance of those chemicals out there. But it's really timing. If the leaves are small on the oak leaves when that is done, that's when they're most susceptible. So if we can shift it a week or two sometimes in one direction, but that's often hard to do. So society's going to have to decide, and we're going to have to work together to see what those options. But we've been talking about this since 1995, and we haven't gone any further. So the more we continue, as we learn on a lot of this stuff, sometimes we have to continue to talk to get to a point where maybe we can make some resolution.
Philip,
thank you for bringing it up.
Thanks a lot for your call. Earl's on the line next in West Des Moines. Hi, Earl.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We've been planting impatiens in the same spot, a couple of three spots around the yard. For the last 15 years, they always grow great. Put them about 14 or 16 inches before the frost gets. But the last 2 years, we plant them, and they just are not thriving. And by the end of July, beginning of August, they'll be dead. They just kind of wither. The leaves fall when we first plant them. Great-looking stock from the nursery. They get a couple of flowers, and then they just slowly fade away. Is there a disease or something going on with impatiens?
That may be impatiens downy mildew. It's a new disease. I think it was introduced or found in Iowa in 2012, I believe. And the first sign of that is if you check the underside of the foliage, there's a white kind of growth on it. And basically what it does, it causes leaf drop. So as the symptoms become more severe and you have more and more leaf drop, essentially you have this kind of naked stem with a few leaves at the very top and very few flowers. So that's typically what you see. So I would examine the underside of the foliage and see if you're seeing that, because it could be impatiens downy mildew. And if it is, you really can't control that with fungicides. Basically, what you want to do is pull up those plants or dig them up and get rid of that plant debris, destroy it, get it out of the area, destroy it, and then look for alternate plants next year, because there are two spores, and there are overproducing spores that will stay in the soil, and overwintering spores that will stay in the soil. So you need to look at different plants, maybe, for example, New Guinea impatiens, or possibly wax begonias, or possibly Tyrrhenia, or something else, coleus, that will grow in partial shade.
All right, Earl, thanks a lot for your call. And you can also go to the demonstration days and
excellent.
Take a look at
thanks
it,
for
some
mentioning
of the other
that.
Impatiens that mm-hmm. are resistant. All right. You're welcome, Cindy.
Thank you.
Next up, let's go to Pat in Coralville. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
What's your question?
Okay. My raspberries get medium size. However, my sister has been asking me for a few years already. She lives in southern Minnesota, and her raspberries only developed into little nubbins, and she keeps asking if I can find some information, if there's some soil deficiency or what she might do to help her raspberries develop into a decent size.
Okay, what type are they? Are they red, black, purple?
The red ones, I believe, okay. The thornless.
Thornless. Well, now, they basically do need full sun, so the site should get at least 6 hours of direct sun per day. They also need to be kind of trained to a 2-foot-wide hedgerow. So you typically have to go out there periodically and maybe destroy some plants. They should not be growing in a large, wide thicket. In that situation, they're not very productive. So they should be kept in a 2-foot-wide hedgerow. They possibly might have a virus, which is a possibility, where you don't really see much in the way of symptoms, but they do not produce good quality fruit. So that could be a possibility, too. If they have a virus, basically, you cannot control that. You basically have to dig up the plants and destroy them. So I guess what I would probably do is make sure they're growing in a 2-foot-wide hedgerow. And if you have to, destroy some of the plants. And I would do that in early spring. And fertilize in the spring also. And I would use like a 10-10-10. And then if they still do not produce well, despite good growing conditions, I would think they might have a virus.
All right, Pat, I hope that helps you and your sister out. Here's a question from Carl. I have a volunteer redbud tree about 5 or 6 feet away from the foundation of my house. I've been pruning it over the past few years, and I would like to keep it there, but is the tree too close to my house foundation?
5 or 6 feet is, I mean, redbuds don't get very large, but if you want to be careful, I would probably think about trying to move it just a little bit, and I would do that next spring. I'd let it go dormant, and then next spring try to move it away from that a little bit. I have a similar situation, and I decided to move mine. That can start to cause some issues.
All right, so how far away is recommended?
For a redbud, I mean, if you can move it a good 10 feet, that would be ideal. And from the size of the tree, too, I mean, 5 feet away from the tree, the kind of pruning that you would have to do to that to kind of keep it off the house and stuff, too. So I would say a minimum of 10 feet if you can do it.
All right. Christy is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
My question is about poison ivy. I live here in Des Moines, and a big portion of my backyard is kind of wild, and it's covered with wildflowers, but I also am plagued with poison ivy, and I don't know how to get rid of the poison ivy, not kill all the wildflowers.
I would say basically you have two options. One is digging. The other is spot treating with Roundup, basically.
And should I do that at the beginning of the year, or does it matter what time of the growing season I do that?
Well, as far as digging, you can do that any time during the year. As far as the Roundup, you want to apply that when the plants are actively growing in full leaf.
All right, Christy.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for your call, and we'll get in one last question on the phone here. Here's Jim in Ankeny. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a thick bladed grass that is creeping into my Kentucky bluegrass fescue on my farmstead. It's a wet grass. It's a heavy grass. What's the best way to get rid of this? I've been pulling it. Is there some sort of other treatment I can do to spot treat this and kill it? What are my options?
Yeah, the key is what kind of grass is it? And so the first thing would be to identify, because we have two types of grasses. We have the annual grasses like crabgrass and foxtail. They die in the fall with the first hard frost or freeze. They come up from seed every spring. We typically don't really see them until maybe mid to late June. And then we see them. They're big enough to see. So that's one type. Then the other type would be a perennial type grass like quackgrass. And we would see that early in the spring. If it's something like quackgrass, there is no selective control. You'd probably have to use Roundup or something of that nature.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jim. And Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Cindy Haynes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Iowa State University Associate Professor of Horticulture. And you can find out information about the Iowa State University Field Days on our Facebook page. You can click on through. And DNR District Forester Mark Bittosh, thank you.
Thank you. You're
and
welcome.
Have a great time on RagBri.
Thanks.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Jason Burns. On Monday, we continue our series on the environment in Iowa with a look at water quality. This is Talk of Iowa.